Big thanks to 2FM Drive Team for getting the evening underway. It's Monday the 22nd of September and you're listening to Game On with me, Ruby Walsh and Andrew O'Connor.
Coming up between now and 7 o'clock, Alan Cawley joins us to look back at yet another busy sporting weekend, which wasn't without its moments of Irish glory. And we'll look back at the World Athletics Championships in Tokyo with Ina Reardon.
Alan will also tell us if Shamrock Rovers will wrap up the League of Ireland Premier Division early, and former Irish international and Spurs star Stephen Kelly will join Alan to discuss the weekend's English Premier League action.
And Raimi Burns joins us ahead of his trip to Bethpage with the Ryder Cup less than 4 days away. As always, if you want to have your say, you can text us on 51552 or WhatsApp us on 087 187 9200.
This is 2FM's Game On.
Well, before we launch into the weekend action, let me give you the brief headlines of the day so far. The Minister for Sport has called on the FAI to review its position in relation to its attendance at a joint Oireachtas committee hearing on sport. Robbie Henshaw is available for Leinster for their opening game of the United Rugby Championship. Para swimmer Roisin Ní Rian has doubled up on her medals tally with another silver medal at the World Championships in Singapore. The steering group charged with overseeing the amalgamation between the GAA, the LGFA and the Camogie Association have published what they call the core principles for integration. On day two of the World Rowing Championships, Fintan McCarthy and Philip Doyle eased into the double semi-finals, and Christian Horner has officially left Red Bull after agreeing his exit from the team. That's about all the headlines, Ruby.
There's a fair bit in there, Andrew, for headlines and plenty of stories I'm sure we'll get into at some point during the week. Alan Cawley, how was your weekend?
Ruby, a busy one as always, but a good one.
Thanks be to God. Yourself?
I think I had the second Alan Cawley weekend in a row.
See, it's catching. It's catching, Ruby.
I'm telling you. I don't know, is it the way forward, though?
I watched four matches on Saturday. I don't know if that's even healthy for you. Because with the introduction of the extra games now and a Saturday night game, so you have 12:30, 3 o'clock, 5:30, 8 o'clock.
And is there still picture and sound in your house and all them?
Yeah. we'll move on swiftly.
What was the highlight? The weekend. It was hardly soccer, was it?
No, it wasn't. No, I'm going to stick to the athletics because that's obviously the theme of the weekend and the success. But slightly different. Everybody's on about Kate, and rightly so. She was absolutely phenomenal and I enjoyed the coverage over the weekend. But I thought Cian McPhillips' run was absolutely amazing for a lad who's so young, and not only, I suppose, the approach that he took and in the race and the way he finished, I thought his interview afterwards, Ruby, was excellent, and he seemed so sure of himself both on and off the track that I think it bodes well for the future for him and a potential star in the making.
I thought they were all brilliant to listen to. I thought Kate O'Connor the same, and Cian McPhillips, and keep going with the rest of them. Sarah Healy, they were all magnificent to listen to. They're incredible speakers.
Yeah, very good speakers, and articulate themselves really well, explain everything well. Even there was one last week, and I think David as well is very good with them and gets a lot out of them because the fact he probably has a relationship or knows them quite well, knows the... no more than yourself, Ruby, if it's racing, knows the game inside out, the correct questions, if you like. So I think all the coverage all weekend was amazing. And in terms of the athletics and where it's going, it seems to be on such a high at the moment. And that's even without potentially the biggest star that we have. Rashida wasn't even there.
I know, yeah. And she will be back listening to Paul McNamara this morning, or reading him actually on the RT website. And Andrew, did you have a highlight?
I had a couple of highlights of the weekend. Manchester United's victory over Chelsea. It happened. It wasn't my highlight.
They're back, Andrew.
Yeah, they're back.
They've turned
again,
the corner,
until Wednesday. until training on Wednesday. But yeah, that was an enjoyable game just for the sheer bonkersness of it. I mean, it was just bonkers. We've seen lots of bonkers things from Man United, but like, they were cruising 2-0 up. Casemiro then gets sent off. It was just a bizarre game. We'll talk more about that later on. My highlight of the weekend, though, was the Grand Prix and Max Verstappen in his apparently slower car. Yeah, giving us a masterclass around the street circuit over the weekend. I mean, I don't know if you saw any of the coverage of it, but the cameras all over the cars now are so close. And the corners in that circuit, I mean, they're literally 2 millimetres away from the barrier. And they have to be two millimetres away from the barrier, because if they're not, then they're not fast enough. But that circuit is bonkers, and the way they go around it is bonkers.
Monaco?
No, it was Azerbaijan.
I didn't see any of it.
It's it's one of those courses that it'd put the wheelies up, you know. If you were coming around those corners sideways and you're hurtling towards and you're putting your foot in the accelerator, I do not know how they do it.
That or riding a horse?
Well...
Oh, riding a horse.
Much tougher.
Riding a horse way easier.
Yeah. Easier?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Well, I mean...
I think the two of them are like crazy extreme, so I wouldn't fancy any of them.
Well, I mean, Ruby's best. Who's going to answer that better than Ruby?
No, that's why I threw it into you, because I don't think any of them are. I think they're both wild. I wouldn't fancy any of them.
Well, I mean, they are. I mean, National Hunt, and we'll talk with Ruby in the room.
It's marching forever, but what about downhill skiing?
Yeah, downhill skiing.
I wouldn't even head a ball on a football pitch, will you? Never mind downhill skiing.
I was watching the Tour of Luxembourg.
What's the Tour of Luxembourg?
It was a cycling race last week.
Yeah, that's tough. Yeah.
And they were coming down a mountain. You know how quick they get going down the mountain. So there was a shot. They were obviously coming down quite a steep mountain. And normally they get up to like 80 kilometres an hour. And you're thinking, wow, that's just madness. So the motorbike was behind the leading group and he was going downhill. And the camera turned around as they were going downhill. And he popped over. You could see this. He just pops the camera over the driver's shoulder. So there's a pinion passenger on the back of the motorcycle with the camera. He puts the camera up above the driver's shoulder and looks at the speedometer. They were going 110 kilometres an hour downhill. And they were behind the cyclists who were going that speed on a bike with a millimetre of Lycra on them.
Yeah, that's, I mean, loads of Lycra to take the impact
off
the tarmac.
Yeah, you wouldn't feel that at all. But anyway.
Ruby, give us your highlight.
My highlight, mine was actually the event. Well, obviously it was the athletics, but to drift away from that, because that was everyone's highlight. Mine was the eventing European Championships in Blenheim Castle, and a great result for the Irish team. Pádraig McCarthy, Robbie Kearns, Aoife Clark and Ian Cassells, with the chef to keep, Dag Albert, claiming silver medal, the first silver medal for an Irish team since the European Championships were in Punchestown when I was a kid. I think it was about 1991. They did win a gold medal back as far as 79, but I thought it was a brilliant result from then. That comes on the back of Austin O'Connor's second place at Burley. So good times for Irish eventing at the weekend, and I thought that was very enjoyable. That's what I spent most of Saturday watching, Alan, was the cross country from Blenheim Castle.
So Ruby, just for those of us who aren't mad up on eventing, there's a couple of different events in it. There's the cross country, there's the dressage.
There's three official phases, but there's also two veterinary trot-ups and inspections that are also actually both phases. So on Wednesday they would have all had to have passed the trot-up to get into the competition. Then they would have done dressage then either Thursday and Friday, half and Thursday, half and Friday. Cross-country Saturday, trot-up Sunday morning, show jump Sunday afternoon. So it is a three-day event, but the two trot-ups are equally as important.
And
so
the trot-ups, are they just to show that the horse is sound and
not lame?
Yeah, does it have to look good as well?
Nah, it has to look good. If it looks tired or fatigued or etc., you won't pass it. Well, it should look fine before you start on Wednesday, but by Sunday they could be a bit fatigued. And it's not as straightforward.
Who's the responsibility, Ruby, of it looking good? The jockey or...
The rider in eventing, yeah. Jockey in racing wouldn't be, but the rider is in eventing. They would have grooms as well, but the rider has to trot the horse in eventing, whereas in horse racing, the groom would always trot the horse for veterinary inspections. The jockey would never be let near it.
Okay. Yeah. And is the dressage something that we're getting better at as a country?
It is, but people get hung up in dressage, and because of trying to make things, I suppose, a little safer equine-wise, they have gone quite tight on times cross-country, Andrew, and there was nobody clear inside the time in Blenheim. So everyone's got hung up in dressage, but every second is one mark, and when you're 15, 20 seconds over, your dressage score can go out the window. So the cross country is still the cross country is the hardest phase, and it's still the most important phase.
It's murder of the dance floor, but the cross country is much worse.
It is. And the English team, four riders, and you have to have three scores to count from four riders. The English team, even though Laura Colley won individual gold for Great Britain, she wasn't on the British team. So Britain had six riders, so did Ireland. Four on your team and three of those scores to count. The three of the British riders failed to complete the cross country. So for the first time in God knows how long, they were out on Saturday.
We had plenty of other options for the weekend highlights. We had Mark Allen winning again in the English Open.
good to see Mark Allen, bit of form. I think it was his first ranking event in over a year, if I'm not mistaken. So, yeah, important win for him. It was a bit of a slog. Now, they were well over 7 hours, I think.
Yeah.
Ronnie O'Sullivan had some critical comments to make as well about them. They're let's just say, I suppose, in soccer parlance, they're quite conservative players. Yeah. Ronnie wants to see them go out and entertain. But everyone can't play snooker like Ronnie.
No, not everybody's Ronnie. Aaron Hill as well. He did very well. First quarter final, I think, of his career.
Yeah, and I watched one of his matches. He beat Jack Lazowski the other night. Yeah, he's progressing very well. It's great to see. Probably the first proper, I suppose, since Ken, really. Mark Allen obviously has been doing really well, but certainly from our neck of the woods down here, Aaron, I think, I'm sure he's from Cork, but he's progressing very well and doing very well. So hopefully he's one for the future, absolutely, because he's mixing it in with the top boys now.
And I don't know if you saw any of the rugby ruby, the Women's World Cup, although Irish sort of interest has gone out of it.
Andrew,
it's rumbling on.
With the refereeing that went on last weekend.
Don't get him started, Andrew.
Well, the French team are hungry.
He was more annoyed than me over VAR calls.
They weren't hungry enough to beat England. And Canada had a famous win over New Zealand as well. So it's a Canada-England final. That's coming up. So
Turn me back on the rugby after last weekend. What about tonight, Al? Real Rovers. Well, they can't technically wrap it up, can you? No, they can't.
No, they can't tonight, but it's coming soon. It is. It's coming soon.
You can go 10 points clear tonight.
And they'd be disappointed. They probably would be closer to wrapping it up tonight had the one on not conceded that late goal on Friday night to Cork. So they dropped 2 points down in Cork Ruby. But yeah, it's only a matter of time. The only ones that closed the gap on them on Friday was Bohemians.
Had a good one.
Buzz. So it's 7 points, but Shamrock Rovers have 2 games in hand. So it is only a matter of time. You'd expect them to beat Waterford tonight. Waterford not in great form, getting dragged right into the mire in terms of the relegation stuff as well. But all eyes tonight will be on Eamon DC Park, Ruby. Massive, massive game between Galway United and Sligo Rovers. Both of them on 31 points. Second from bottom and third from bottom. And of course, everybody knows if you finish second from bottom, you will go into the playoff where nobody wants to be. So that's a huge game. And I've watched Galway twice in the last week, in the cup game last week. And I actually watched them again Friday night against Pat. Same opposition both nights. They didn't win any of the games, but they played very well, to be fair, in both games. So that'll be a tough game for Sligo Rovers, especially coming off the back of the cup defeat, which was a disaster for them last week when they were 3-0 against Kerry. But they did bounce back on Friday night with a 1-1 draw at home to Drogheda. So hopefully that cup defeat is out of their system. But that's a huge game tonight in Eamon DC Park.
I know it's sort of okay for us Leinster boys to sort of have a little snigger when you say the big game is Galway and Sligo. But talk to me about that game. As a Sligo man, how much love is lost between Galway United and Sligo Rovers, Alan? Is it that rivalry that sort of... really hate each other?
Not necessarily. I wouldn't say hate.
Is it respect?
A rivalry more geographical terms, to be fair, rather than kind of what's been built up over the years that they've
been
fighting.
It's the Connacht Derby.
More or less, yeah. And that's the reason I say it's such a big game is because of where they are in the table more so than anything else, Andrew. That's why it's the biggest game of the night. In that regard, Shamrock Rovers are obviously away to Waterford, St. Pat's at home to Cork. So there's not as much, if you like, on the other games. There's a fair bit on Drogheda and Shelburne because both of them are trying to finish in that kind of fourth place. And both of them are on 43 points. Shelburne have a game in hand on Drogheda, and Drogheda in recent weeks, when you think of the unbelievable start, they have dropped off a little, but they're still in with a fighting chance of that European place. But as I say, the big game tonight for me is down there at the bottom, Galway Sligo Rovers. Hopefully Sligo Rovers can get the victory, but I don't think it will be easy because, as I said, I've watched Galway twice in the last week and they've played very well.
And you said Cork City got a point at the weekend off Shamrock Rovers. They're obviously playing Pats, they're coming to Dublin. Fair to Cork City, they've been in alright form the last couple of games.
They have, you're right, Ruby, yeah. They've certainly turned things around a little bit, if you like. Now, the victories that they've had have been against teams kind of down below, down at the bottom of the table with them. They beat Waterford, they beat Finn Harps in the cup, which was a good win as well. They beat Waterford in the cup, so they've beaten them twice. Also, they beat Galway a couple of weeks back. So when you think of how difficult it was for Gerard Nash when he went in, David Myler as well, I think it was 8 or 9 games before he got his first victory, and it was certainly doom and gloom. The clouds are slowly beginning to lift. They're still bottom of the table, Ruby. They won't beat relegation this year. They'll get relegated, but they're in the semi-final of the cup as well. And I also think in terms of next year, they will be in a they'll be in a much stronger position, that if they do go down, you would like to think they'll bounce back up. And I don't think that will be a bad thing now with Gerard Nash and Myler at the helm, because they can get themselves ready with a good first division campaign and come back into the Premier Division much stronger and much better set up to kind of give a better account of themselves in the Premier Division. They still have the semi-final though, and I wouldn't rule them out against St. Pat's. St. Pat's have been the form team in the league the last couple of weeks, themselves and Shelburne. But as you say, Cork City Rugby have turned things around. So that'll be a tough night next week down in Turner's Cross. There'll be a huge crowd at it as well. So that gives them a slight distraction from the league as well for Gernash, and to have the cup and to be a huge crowd at it. But as I said, with them kind of getting to grips with the job in hand now, it won't be a bad thing if they get relegated, which they will, and steady the ship in the First Division, get themselves back up into the Premier Division and hopefully kick on from there.
When you look at those three teams that are in 7th, 8th and 9th, being Galway, Sligo Rovers and Waterford, run-in wise, with only 6 games left, which of them has the best matches coming? Like Waterford obviously have Shamrock Rovers again, Galway have Sligo, that's tonight, then you've Galway and Cork on Friday night, whereas Sligo have St. Pat's. Like, which one of them do you think has the easiest run in? Or Waterford have Shells away next weekend as well. Like, are Waterford the ones that are starting to struggle most out of those three teams?
I think up to last week, Ruby, I would have said Sligo Rovers were in a great position because they had certainly a lot of momentum behind them. They've Owen Elding, who's an absolute star, scoring goals. But that defeat down in Kerry last week, that when they were 3-0 up, I thought that could absolutely derail the season. Now, good news for them is that they steadied the ship in their first game back on Friday night against Drogheda. So that bodes well. Obviously a huge game tonight. You look at Waterford, and as you say, they're running. They've Shamrock Rovers tonight. They've Shelburne away after that. They've Drogheda at home. They've Derry at home. And then St. Pat's. So that's 5 out of the top 6 that they're going to play in their running. So that's a very, very difficult running. You look at Galway then, and their fixtures are Sligo Rovers at home tonight. They've Cork City at home next. So they're 2 good ones for Galway, if you like, if they can get the points. Bohemians away, Drogheda, and then Waterford. So I would say, out of the 5 fixtures that they've left, they have a much better run in Galway. You look at Sligo Rovers, and their fixtures is obviously the one we said in Galway tonight. Then they're at home to Pats, they're away to Derry, they're away to Shelburne, and then they're at home to Cork. So they have 4 really tough games before that one against Cork. So they need to get points on the board out of those 4 games before they face Cork. I would say, looking at that, Ruby, Galway have the best running out of the fixtures. And as I said, they played quite well the last couple of weeks. Waterford would be the ones I'd be worried about out of them three that are down the bottom, because their fixture list is horrendous when you look at Shamrock Rovers, Shelburne, Drogheda, Derry and St. Pat's.
Okay, we've given the league to Rovers already.
Yeah.
Mathematically, with those games in hand, we've spoken about the bottom end of the table. Let's talk about just behind Rovers, those that chase for European places. At the moment, Bohemians on 2nd, 50 points with 31 games. Derry also 31 games, also 50 points. Shells have 2 games in hand on 29 games, 43 points. Pats, 43 points with 30 games. And then Drogheda, 30 games, 43 points. How do you see those heading in? How will that get concertinaed?
Okay, I'll make it very simple for this one. I'm giving Bohemians a place. They're in on 50 points, and Derry are in on 50 points. I think it comes down to the next 3 then, Andrew. St. Pat's, Shelburne and Drogheda, who are all on 43 points at the moment. Shelburne have a game in hand though on St. Pat's and Drogheda. They're in the best form, them and St. Pat's, so I'm ruling Drogheda out. So now I've narrowed it down to Pat's and Shelburne for that last place.
Will Shelburne be distracted by Europe?
Potentially. But then you could argue, Pats, would they be distracted by the Cup semi-final? I think the Cup semi-final is a good thing for them. I don't think that's a distraction. Shelburne is, because logistically you'll be travelling as well in between games. They're far greater intensity in terms of the games that they'll play against European opposition. So that could be a hindrance to them in terms of the league. But I still think they have enough of a squad to deal with that. And I'm not convinced on St. Pat's, even though they're in good form and have certainly turned things round since the mid-season slump. I'm just not convinced by them. I'm really not. So I'm going to go Shelburne to get that last place. But the good news for them is, if the Shamrock Rovers go on and win, we've given them the league. If they win the cup, it'll free up another place as well. So that helps those teams that are battling out for that 4th place.
Okay, we're going to talk a lot more association football later on in the programme with Stephen Kelly. We'll go through all of the English Premier League. We might touch on Celtic and Rangers in Scotland as well. And we've got Athletics after the break.
Game on. Athletics.
Anna Hall moves away. The gold medal is about 100 metres away from her. And the silver medal is around 100 metres away from Kate O'Connor right now. It hurts, but she's giving it everything. The knee hurts, I'm sure. And there's a slight element, maybe even of a slight limp, maybe not, but certainly Kate O'Connor is doing all she needs to do here. Kate O'Connor is the World Championship silver medalist. What a thing to be able to say. Oh, injury or not, she ran a really, really strong race. Not far off her best. And considering the effort that she's put in over the 7 events, including a best in the javelin off a Bocchetti knee.
Oh my gosh, it was amazing. It was everything that I could have dreamed of. Seeing all the Irish flags out there as well was so nice, and all the familiar faces. Yeah, such a proud moment.
You've had amazing support, and even there in front of that stage, so many Irish.
Oh, 100%. It was class. Like, I suppose we're so far away from home, but it's just so nice to actually still feel the love and the support here. And obviously, everybody at home watching too. I've seen it on social media. I haven't been on too much, but I plan on going through everything and, yeah, saying just thanks to as much people as I can.
This medal now puts you up with some of the greatest Irish athletes ever. Has it sunk in?
No, not at all. And I think it'll be a while till it sinks in. Like, sometimes I'm standing here and I like still feel a little bit like an imposter. So yeah, I think it'll just take a wee while to like realise what I've done and realise that like I do fully belong here. Yeah, but it's really exciting.
This medal is obviously around your neck, but an awful lot of people have made it happen. Your dad, Tom, and the whole kind of backroom team. You know, what would you like to say to them?
I feel like I'm going to be forever in debt to them. Winning this medal wouldn't have been possible without the team that I have around me, the support, the love, the kindness that they all show, the dedication. It's not just from me, it's also from them. So yeah, I'll have to say thank you every day now for the rest of my life, because moments like this don't happen without support like that.
And going back to yesterday, obviously plain sailing on day one, and then day two yesterday, the injury, the knee, you've got through it, you're now on the podium. All of that turmoil, you know, when you look back now, how does it make you feel?
I feel like I fought really hard, and I think that like in days to come I'll look back and I think it'll be a great story to tell in the future, how I like fought through adversity and still managed to come out the other side. I'm so proud of myself, so proud of my team, I finally have it hanging around my neck.
It's 4 medals this year, but this one's probably a little bit sweeter, is it?
Oh, definitely. I mean, like, winning a world outdoor medal is like the stuff that I would have dreamed of like as a kid, and like these girls that I'm competing against, I watched them growing up and now I'm beating some of them, so it's insane.
So what's next?
Chill out. Just chill out. I haven't really thought too much about next year or what's coming up. I just want to live in this moment and enjoy it as much as I can, and then I'll just take whatever comes my way and my stride, but I'm definitely looking forward to building on this, but a couple of weeks off now is well deserved.
Take whatever comes in her stride. Well, she most certainly took Tokyo in her stride. In her stride, did Kate O'Connor. Ian O'Riordan from the Irish Times joins us now. Ian, what a performance! What an athlete! What a year for Kate O'Connor!
It was, Ruby. Yeah, no, just that was the first time I've heard Greg Allen's commentary there, and I suppose a bit like myself, Greg's been knocking around the sport for many years, and I think it's fair to say none of us really had ever even imagined that we'd have a best all-round athlete in the world, a multi-event athlete, man or woman. And for Kate O'Connor to do that essentially in 1 year, I mean, she's competed before in the Olympics last year, we know, but I mean, to come out this year, win a European indoor medal, a world indoor medal, the World University Games, and then a World Championship medal, is really absolutely astonishing. And I think I'm at the age as well to remember, I suppose, 1983, the first World Championships in Helsinki, when Eamon Coughlin famously won his gold medal, and that iconic moment when he passes the Russian and clenches his fist. But I mean, Coughlin was an absolutely seasoned athlete then. He'd finished 4th in the Olympics, and he was world record holder indoors in the miles. He was a really established athlete, and I suppose that's the kind of athlete it takes maybe to win a World Championship medal. And people maybe thought this was going to happen all the time at World Championship level. Instead, it was Sonia Sullivan was the next athlete to win in 93, and then you're waiting another, I don't know how many years for Gillian O'Sullivan, and then Olive McNan in the walks, and then of course Rob Heffernan. And so like these medals don't come around very often. I mean, she's only the 6th Irish athlete to to win a medal in the World Championships. And as she said herself, she's 24 years old and only getting going. And then, of course, 70 minutes later, Keane McPhillips very nearly outdoes her and nearly wins the gold medal. Because I swear to God, if there was another 10 metres in that race, he would have won the gold medal, because he was finishing faster than everyone. I think he timed his effort almost to perfection, but unfortunately just ran out of track. But he's only 23. That was his first World Championship. So, I mean, in those two performances alone, it's unquestionably, I suppose, the best championships Ireland has ever had. But if you look at the depth as well, if you look back and think we've had, I think it's seven top 12 overall, top 12 kind of being the sort of finalist sort of level. So we've had seven top 12, and that's definitely more than we've ever had. Three national records, obviously. McPhillips breaking it twice. And I definitely think athletics is in a good place. And of course, this is without our two best athletes, Rashid Adeleke and Kira McGee. And for sadly contrasting reasons, we're nowhere near Tokyo. Well, actually, I think Rashid was in Tokyo as a spectator. But 2 years ago at the World Championships in Budapest, they both finished fourth, a close fourth. And you're kind of thinking, well, their chance might come now in Tokyo. And Rashida came out again last summer, finished fourth in the Olympics. So it goes to show there's no guarantees at the same time. That it's nice to think that obviously we'll see a lot more of Cater Connor, and we will. And I'm not certainly trying to dampen the mood here at all, but I think she's right there. She said it herself. Just enjoy the moment now for what it is. And she'll worry about the European Championships next year. And God, I can even mention the next Olympics in Los Angeles. But in terms, as I say, of the actual Irish performances, it's been the best ever.
I think one of the greatest phrases ever in sport was seeing is believing. And when you see what Kate O'Connor, Keane McPhillips, you mentioned Kira McGeen, Rashid Adeleke, when you look at what Irish athletics has achieved in the last 18 to 24 months, surely it's inspirational. It's encouraging more people, and the future is only getting brighter.
Yeah, they are role models. And that's why just listening to Kate O'Connor there, like, so thoughtful, so articulate, so appreciative as well of her situation. And one thing that's worth pointing out about both Kate and Keane is they're entirely homegrown. I mean, I've made the point before that a lot of our athletes have had to go away. We've got a great tradition of American scholarships. I went there myself many years ago because that was kind of the thing you had to do, was go to America to kind of pursue your career. And it's worked for Rashida. But I think Cater Connor, she's coached by her father. She's completely homegrown. Keane McPhillips is up in UCD now, but still has the same coach, Joe Ryan, who he's had for years when he first came through in Longford. So I think that's a big lesson as well, how important it is to put yourself in the right environment. And but I mean, funny, I'm still trying to get my head around that men's 800 metres, by the way. I mean, it was the times in that race alone were just nuts. I mean, he would have won the Keane McPhillips would have won the gold medal in every other World Championships with that time, with his 142.15. I mean, I think it was the first time ever it has been the top eight men all ran sub 143. It was a championship record. So to do that kind of performance, as he said himself, it took the three Olympic medalists to beat him. So I'm not comparing performances at all, because I mean, Kate had to beat the Olympic champion and the world champion as well. So that was the standard that we're talking about here. There was no sort of weakness in either of those events. So it's really positive there. But again, it's not getting too carried away. There's another world championships before the Los Angeles Olympics in 2028. So there's a long way to go in the next Olympic cycle. But at the same time, I don't think athletics could be in a better place right now, building on that in terms of the depth, in terms of the range of performances and young athletes coming through as well. I know it wasn't a great championship for Sophia Sullivan. She had some injuries, but she definitely showed her potential again. I was looking at some names there. Dara McElhenney as well in 5,000 metres ran very well. We had finalists in the men's and women's 1500 metres and Sarah Healy, Andrew Coskren. Like, that's never happened before. We've had a men's and women's finalist. So I could go on like that, but I think that's the point to make about these championships. Like, they really were, I mean, looking at the bigger picture, like, World Athletics like to make these kind of claims that they were the most competitive championships ever, but they actually were, because I think it was 53 different countries won medals. That's the most ever. There was a world record. There was nine championship records, 62 national records. So, like, these were definitely the most competitive championships that I can remember as well. So for Ireland to be that competitive on a stage like that, certainly, yeah, certainly augurs well.
And, you know, give a creditable mention to Fionnuala McCormack as well in the women's marathon. I think that was her best finish in the World Championships with a ninth placed finish. And we'll come back to the women's marathon in a little while because I want to ask you something else about that. But going back to Kate, I mean, of the seven events, she had five personal bests, which in a major championships, I suppose that's what you dream of, but it's pretty ridiculous. My question to you is, though, how high is her ceiling? She's obviously looked at each event and thought, I can get a few more points here, I can get a few more points there, I can push this, I can stretch that. How far do you think she can go in terms of her points total?
Yeah, well, I mean, she said, we spoke to her before Tokyo, and she said, if I can break 6,500 points, I'll be delighted, and that might put me in the mix. What did you do? 6,714. So, I mean, it's she's already surpassed, I think, where she thought she was going to be in Tokyo. But you're right. I mean, like, she's a freak. I mean, I mean that in the best possible terms. She is a freak because what she's doing in the running, the throwing, the jumping, making it look easy, which we all know it's not. And again, this is an event where we don't have the tradition of say middle distance running or even sprinting to some extent. So, to answer your question, I'm not entirely sure how much better she can get because she keeps raising the bar for herself. Anna Hall from the USA, who won the gold medal, she's the same age. She's only 24, but she's already broken 7,000 points. So she's going to be around for the next 3 years. And that's the target that Kate wants to aim for now. She's like, I can actually compete with Anna, possibly beat her someday. She didn't have a great, I mean, I'm just looking at the events maybe where she can improve, possibly the shot put. Obviously, we saw she wasn't quite up the top there. But, I mean, her 800-meter time, I mean, to run 2:09 at the end of a two-day event like that is fantastic. On a dodgy knee, yeah. I mean, the knee thing, we're all scared by that. But look, I'm not playing it down, but I think it was probably more a precaution that she just didn't do the last javelin throw to make sure that she was 100% right. I was wide as she could be for the 800 metres. But again, that's a kind of a gentle reminder that you just don't know. And the first event, the 100-metre hurdles, I mean, you could literally hit the first hurdle and your entire heptathlon challenge is over. So it's fine margins. It's a high-risk event as well. But she's absolutely timed everything right this year. She didn't compete really. Okay, she did the indoors, but then she only did one outdoor heptathlon. So she was going there at her peak as well. I think it'll be good to have a bit of a down year next year, as in it's only a European Championships, but she'll certainly be going to the next World Championships, which are in Beijing, another long way away, believing now that she can possibly challenge for the gold medal, yeah.
And would she think that she'll be favoured to win a gold at the European Championships in her own mind?
Well, she beat Katrina Johnson-Thompson from the UK, from Britain's World Champion, so she's right now, she is the best in Europe. And the same with Keane McPhillips. He was the top European in the men's 800, obviously. So, like, no pressure going into, what is it, Birmingham next summer. But, look, that's a long way away yet. But we really hope we'll have Rashid Adeleke back next year as well. And I know Sonia Sullivan wrote a column for us there a few weeks ago. And she got some criticism, I think, for what she said, some of the things she said about Rashida. But this was purely tough love. And I think we've seen that now in the results that we have in Tokyo, that it's how important it is to be in the right environment and be happy with your setup. Now, I'm not saying there's anything particularly wrong with Adeleke's setup in Texas, but she set herself, she had some setbacks, some roadblocks, and she's trying to get herself right again. So sometimes you have to maybe shake things up a little bit. And that was a point Sonia was trying to make, that you need to listen to maybe other people's advice or opinions about where you need to go. Because Sonia went through that herself post Atlanta in 96, all those years ago. So, and again, if you look at Adeleke's event in Tokyo, I mean, Sydney McLaughlin comes out and nearly breaks the world record, which is stood for 40 years. So that event has already moved on. So the sport is constantly changing like that in different events. So we don't know where the heptathlon's going to be next year. Maybe there's another one that's going to come out of the woodwork like Kate has. So there's no guarantees like that. But definitely, I think they're absolutely in the right place now. Like they can build on this. Kate can go back to her coaching team and Dundalk, and the same for Keane in UCD, and they don't need to change anything. They just need to make small little tweaks to try and be that little bit better, because there's no obvious weaknesses right now in either of them, which is a really positive thing as well.
And a question to you about Keane McPhillips as well. Obviously, he's always been very quick since he was young, But he got an injury and he really trained and trained on that fast finish, which we all saw and enjoyed and shouted at the television in all of his races, his heats, his semi-finals and his final. What does he have to do to go quicker in the first 400? And will that take away from how he finishes the second 400?
It is. It's a good question, Andrew, and I'm really showing my age now, but I remember Dave Wattle, the American with the cap, who 1972 Olympics in Munich, I think it was, sat right at the back, and a bit like what Keane did on Saturday, came sprinting down the home straight to win the gold medal, because that was the way that was the strength that he had was the fast finish. And as you say, if you go out fast and you try and stick with the leader, there's a real danger you're not going to finish like that. And I mean, I've no doubt that if Keane had tried to go out in, what was it, 49 seconds, he was about a half a second off that, I think he would have been eaten alive in the home straight. So this is his strength. This is how he runs his race. And I think that will always be the way he runs his race. Because he's a very smart guy as well. He's got a great tactical brain, and that's not something that you can take for granted either. Now, he's a student of math, so I assume he can work out his split times pretty good. But look, he'll go away. And don't forget, Keane McPhillips started out really as a 1,500 metre runner. And I think of the late, great Gerry Kiernan, who was always talking about athletes moving up a distance to reach their peak. And I think we will see Keane McPhillips run the 1,500 metres possibly in the next 3 or 4 years. And dare I say, that's where his real potential might shine. Because if he can run a 51, 52 second lap at the end of a 1,500 metres, he's going to be nearly unbeatable. So really exciting times there. But you're right, he's been through some rough period. And I remember him being an outstanding junior. And like, how many outstanding juniors fall through the cracks for a variety of reasons? But he's just kept us. He's been patient. He's shown that resilience to come through, and it's great for him as well. Another, as I say, entirely homegrown athlete who stayed at home, and he paid a lot of credit as well to Martina McCarthy, and I think she's worth a shout out up in the Sport Ireland Institute, who has worked with a lot of athletes, going back to Kieran McGeehan as well, to develop that strength and speed as well. So it's great to have all this positive talk about athletics that's very much homegrown.
And before we let you go, very briefly, the non-Irish stories that caught your eye during the championships. You had Melissa Jefferson Wooden, the 100 and 200 double. Noah Lyles scorching to a fourth successive world 200 metres. Mondo Duplantis with another centimetre on top of his world record. He gets $100,000 every time he breaks that world record. No wonder he only puts it up by a centimetre a go. And Julia Paternan of Uruguay with that brilliant performance in the women's marathon. She didn't know that she crossed the line. She didn't know she was third. It was only her second ever marathon. That was a great story. What story in the championships caught your eye?
Yeah, well, it was a daily dose, I think. Like, every day there was something like that. And as I mentioned, there was 9 championship records there across the board. But one of the races that really fascinated me yesterday was the men's 5,000 metres, because you had Jacob Ingebrigtsen, who we all know was injured and was trying to salvage something. He couldn't do it. But the American Cole Hocker, you might remember, won the 1,500 metres in Paris last summer. Then he didn't make the final here because he was disqualified. So he came out in the 5,000 metres yesterday and just did exactly what he did. Sat at the very back. I think he was 9th or 10th at the bell. And then he just blew them all away in the last lap and crossed the line to win the gold medal. So that was a huge performance for him. Really, really nice guy. His agent is Ray Flynn, another Longford athlete. So there's another kind of a Longford connection there, which we'll credit. So... But overall, Andrew, yeah, as I say, I think I don't remember championships where every day there seemed to be championship records or really close finishes. I mean, as I mentioned, the women's 400 meter championship record had stood since 1983. Maybe the less said about that, the better. So all around, I mean, Tokyo deserved to take a bow, and it seems like a long way away to the next World Championships. But I think it's going to be a hard act to follow.
Ian, thanks for joining us on Game On. Irish Athletics is on the up, and after the break, we're going to talk English Premier League.
Game On Athletics. This is
2FM.
Game On Association Football.
Welcome back to Game On, where we're going to turn our attention to last weekend's action in the English Premier League. And Stephen Kelly joins us on the line. Alan Colley is still in studio. Stephen Kelly, 5 games gone, 5 wins in Liverpool, 15 points. They were just too good for Everton, weren't they?
I thought Everton put up a good fight the second half, got back into it, looked dangerous. I think Jack Grealish looks a man reinvented, But yeah, I think they're both too good. Too many good substitutes. Ekitike, even though it's weird, a lot of people question him, even though he's scored four already for Liverpool. But great goal I thought from him. Great touch, great finish. Gravenberch's goal was beautiful. It was just such a lovely goal. Passing from Salah, reversed, kind of chip over the top of the goalkeeper. And that's without them actually playing that well, which is a scary thought, I think.
It is. And I was talking to a few Liverpool fans, Alan, and they're of the same opinion. They've won five games, yet they have only hit about third gear, according to them.
Yeah, and I suppose the narrative around it is that's the sign of champions, Ruby. But I'd be a little bit concerned. Just the fact that they're not killing teams off. They're not, as you say, playing to their full potential, if you like. But they'll just point to the league table and say we're 5 points clear. So it's fairly ominous for the rest of them, because they will hit top gear at some point. But I would be just slightly concerned. Even in the first half, when they were two up, you think to go off and kill the game. But as Stephen said, Everton gave a really good account of themselves, and they allowed the game, I suppose, become a bit of a nervous one in the second half, because they conceded that goal. And they are conceding goals. Going forward, they're such a threat. And as Stephen said also about Ekitike, he's been brilliant. And Isak has to come into it. And I thought he looked sharp in the European game during the week against Atletico Madrid as well. So it does look ominous for the rest of them. But I'd be a little bit concerned, Ruby. I'd want to see them playing a little bit better than what they are at the moment.
So would I. Arsenal, Man City. City were on the break the whole time. Arsenal, if Arsenal are going to challenge Liverpool, Stephen, they need to get more out of these games.
Yeah, I think... I kind of expected Arsenal to win that game. I was like, I thought, at home, Arsenal, proved squad, players doing better, attacking options, players can bring off the bench. I thought they'd get through it, and City just causing problems. Like, a couple of times Haaland went through. This great goal for the first one, taking his right foot, but when he went through the second time, he should have put Foden in. Just a little bit of Greek kick in, and listen, sometimes you can't blame the strikers for that, but that was an unbelievable opportunity to go 2-1 up, and, you know, nicking that with a wonderful finish from Martinelli in the second half to get back into. But these are the games that Arsenal, if you want to show real credentials to go on and win it, I think they're the games you have to win at home, and regardless of who it is, you have to put your best foot forward. And I don't think they're doing that, and the title's just going to creep away from them.
It's crept away from them already. But Al, we're going to change the conversation a little bit, because everyone knows the results by now. It is Monday evening. What about West Ham, Wolves and Villa from last year to this year? What has gone wrong with the three of them?
Yeah, it's amazing the turnaround. And when you think the Wolves manager only signed a new contract last week as well. And I thought that was good to back him and support him, because he did very well when you think back to the end of last season when he did come in. He turned their whole season around and he ended up finishing comfortable in the table. But it's been a dreadful start. It really has. West Ham, I'm not surprised by, Ruby. I have to be honest with you. When you think of no real kind of signings, recruitment, they haven't given Potter much of a chance. The Villa one is the most surprising for me, because when you think of the job that Emery has done, unbelievable the last two seasons, but they haven't backed them in the transfer market. And when you think of the players they were signing last year, albeit on loan, the likes of Rashford and Asensio, and it was looking like Villa were really going places, but this season... Even I watched the game against Sunderland yesterday, and they scored the goal. Sunderland had a player sent off, Matty Cash, and you're thinking, well, this will be the first day now. They'll just see out the game and get a victory. But to allow a 10-man Sunderland back in, and yes, the atmosphere was up, as you'd expect in the stadium, like, but they still should be dealing with it better. And whatever about the ability of the players, we know they've a good squad. Their mentality at the moment, something's gone wrong in terms of the manager and certainly the players, and it doesn't seem all as well in that camp whatsoever. Obviously, the results reflect that as well, but I think he looks despondent, Emery, at the moment, because of maybe what's gone on in the off-season. Now, he's very professional. He doesn't come out and make a public, I suppose, is his annoyance, if you like. But certainly you look at his body language and the way things are. Even at one stage, he shook hands with the Sunderland manager, walked down the tunnel, which I didn't think looked great either from his point of view. But all is not well in that camp.
Well, certainly isn't. Stephen, if there are three teams that are struggling, surely Sunderland and Leeds must be delighted with the start they've had to their life in the Premier League.
Oh, they'd be absolutely buzzing. I think on the back of the last two seasons where you've had all the promoted sides get relegated 2 years in a row, you don't want to be part of that kind of statistic again. So to start off the way they have, but it's always about beating those teams around you, those mini leagues, and it's such a cliche, but that's what they've done. They've capitalised on the teams that have struggled, but you look at Wolves, like, Wolves have been awful. And I, West Ham, I think he's gone. I think if they don't go get Nuno now, someone else will. And I think that's what they're thinking. I fully believe that Nuno Santos Espirito will be in as the new West Ham manager sometime in the near future.
What about your own team, Spurs, then? They should have. I know it was non goal in the end, but they had all the pressure on Brighton. They deserve a draw.
Yeah, they did deserve a draw. I think they got back into it, conceded two goals early on, and looked like, I thought, is this, we're seeing the real Spurs now, back to losing games away from home, but they showed good grit and determination, some good goals. Simmons should have got one or two potential. I think he looked really sharp coming off the bench, really good introduction, and I think he's a great asset to have, but decent results. Yeah, it wasn't bad. I was actually at the Fulham Brentford game, so I was at Keith Andrews, I was at that match. So
well,
that wasn't a bad one either. Yeah, Brentford started well, pressed really well, but as soon as Fulham conceded, they just were lost for ideas. Collins a bit rickety for the mistake, for the goal, doesn't clear it properly, and then Fulham just pouncing. They just looked a little bit jaded, I felt. They just didn't have enough about them to get back after Fulham in the second half, and Fulham just canted to the win in the end.
They most certainly did. Stephen Kelly, thanks a million for joining us. Same to you, Alan Colley, because we're going to turn our attention to the Ryder Cup, because Remy Burns, Remy, I'm not going to sound jealous, I'm absolutely green. You're getting on a plane in the morning to Bethpage, working for Ryder Cup Radio. That's a proper gig.
It's a proper gig. Someone has to do it, Ruby, obviously, but I'm looking forward to it. You know, it's been 2 years since Rome, four, you know, whatever years since Paris, but it's a fabulous opportunity. I've worked with these guys for quite a while now when they asked me, invited me over, so I'm really looking forward to Bethpage, looking forward to this Ryder Cup. It's going to be such an exciting Ryder Cup. You know, it's going to be a phenomenal New York City, New York crowd, Europe trying to win, so retain the trophy. It'll be a fabulous occasion for golf all over the world.
It most certainly will. They're starting morning foursomes, afternoon four balls, 7:10 on Friday morning, which is just after midday for us. What kind of an atmosphere are you expecting? Will it be as raucous as they're suggesting?
It will be. I mean, Paris was incredible with the Atlantic wave. Rome was phenomenal with the sort of Pavarotti music beforehand and the build-up so early in the morning. But I think in New York, you may have some Frank Sinatra. I'd say you may have some music, and some players normally come out, vice captains come out, get the crowd going from early morning with some music. I think it'll be a complete ruckus. It'll be like Frank Sinatra's arrived in New York City for the 3 days. It'll be huge. Keegan Bradley is a very, very popular character, very popular captain, and the player. I think the team itself is a well-balanced team, and with Scheffler number one in the world leading the way, and I think they want this really bad. You know, they want to beat Europe really bad. Got a bit of a drumming in Italy, and they'll be up for it.
Does the Ryder Cup need a close competition?
I think it does, yes. For the excitement of Sunday singles, it needs to be close, I think, the whole way around. It's I've heard the golf course has been a little bit more open, a little bit more of a birdie fest. That's according to a couple of caddies that I've spoken to over the last couple of days. So, you know, the people, it's a show. It's show business, the Ryder Cup. People want to see birdies. They don't want to see people bogeying holes. And I do think it'll be a close. Most of the matches had been over the previous years. It's always a, like Shane Lowry made, I think, 10 birdies in Italy. Rory was 8 under when he won. You know, a couple of mistakes. The trophy goes the opposite way. It's all down to making birdies, hitting the crucial shots the right time. We saw Tommy hit that green in 16 last year to get the win for Europe. You know, playing under the pressure. It's who can hit those important shots under pressure will be vital coming down the stretch. And I think Europe has that sort of attention. They're a crafty team, this bunch, and there's some talent in it, and they've played really, really, really well. Most of the players, Justin Rose, they're 46, nearly 47 years old, leading the way of the team. Rory McIlroy, John Rahm, Hatton, Larry, you know, you're such a really well-balanced team. Both teams are very well-balanced, in fact. Some great players played really well on both sides. I think we'll be in for an unbelievable weekend, Ruby.
7:10 Friday morning. What four players are standing on the tee box?
In my opinion, it'll be Rory McIlroy and Fleetwood. And I'm hoping Scotty Scheffler, Bryson DeChambeau, but that could be Scotty Scheffler and somebody else, depending on what ball they play. But certainly, I think Rory and Fleetwood will definitely be out first. They'll put the par couple out, I think, in the first tee. I think afternoon foursomes, I think Rory and Shane will play, and, you know, possibly Hatton and John Rahm, Oberg and Hovland. I'm not sure about McIntyre, possibly with Rose, Justin Rose. That could be your first eight players in the morning. That's what I'm hoping. He'll play all the players, obviously, the first day. Both teams, I think, personally, will play both players unless somebody's very ill or very sick. But it's going to be an incredible weekend of festival of golf, especially in one of the best cities in the world.
What kind of a score would you hope it is on Saturday evening?
Saturday evening, I'd like to be at least 2-1. I'd like to go into the singles for Europe 2 ahead, because the singles, as we know in the past, but the European team has changed a lot. You know, when we went over, Europe has gone over from 87, say, when they won, and back at different, you know, you had 7 or 8 top players. Not taken away from any of the last 4 or 5 players in the team, but every player now is a world player, world standard. They're top standard golfers. They can make so many birdies and eagles in a round of golf. So the singles isn't, you know, has been important statistically, but I think as time goes on, there's so many great players. The top 12 players are there's not an awful lot of difference between either of them. So it just comes down to who can handle the pressure the best. Who's got the most Henrys coming down the stretch? Who's able to hit the shots under pressure? That's the key, you know, yourself, you know.
Oh, stop. That's what it is. It'll be an incredible weekend. So, well, Friday, Saturday and Sunday, Ramy Burns, you enjoy yourself. Safe flight to New York. I wish I was going.
Thank you, Ruby.
It'll be incredible. Would you like to be going, Andrew?
I would love to be going. Ramy, have you any space in that suitcase?
Any room, loads of seats.
Lovely,
loads of seats.
Lovely. We'll be there. I would love to go, Ruby.
I'll bring you back a bar of rock. Don't worry,
We'll take it. Ramy, thanks for joining us on Game On. Well, and Ruby, you're heading to Listowel tomorrow.
I am. I'm off to Listowel tomorrow, and of course, the Guinness Kerry National is the feature on Wednesday afternoon, Andrew. So, big race, big pot. I think 3-card Bragg was a bit unlucky in the Galway Plate myself, and he might make amends for Gordon Elliott and Jack Kennedy in the Kerry National at about 4:20, I think, on Wednesday afternoon. But yeah, huge crowds in the stall. All flat today, all flat tomorrow. But from Wednesday on, the place will be rammed on the island in the stall.
Great excitement. That all means that I'll be here on my own from 6 o'clock on 2FM in the company of Kieran Murphy from Second Captains. Kieran will be discussing his new book, Notes on Hurling, the Old Parish. Plus, Mark Langdon and Paul Curry will talk soccer, and Jeff Shepherd and Brian O'Leary start our NFL countdown to Croke Park. Yes, all roads lead to Jones's Road, especially in the NFL this week. Up next here on 2FM, it's the new music show with Rachel Mayhannon.
RTE 2FM. Right now, this is 2FM's Game On. This is 2FM.